can't find work no matter where he looks. We're on the dole, we're busted flat. Thought of growing some weed back in the woods, but we don't want our kids mixed up in that. It was borrow now and foreclose later. We're up to our keisters and alligators. Don't know what we can do. It's gonna take a miracle to pull us through. And then this fella came up to our door, offering money to mine out back. He said, you'll be getting paid for nothing, folks, if you'll just sign here and let us frack. So we can be rich on shattered land, or poor on land that's whole. Yeah, that's the choice they're offering. Hey, mister, it's like a bounty on our souls. Our kids are learning to do without. There's more to life than clothes and toys. And yeah, we'd love to give them everything, but this is the devil's choice. And I say it sounds too good to be true, and I ask the man, what's the risk of cancer? And he says, you can have your money up front, you know, that ain't no kind of answer. 'Cause if it's money now and tumors later, you shove your hydraulic fracturator. Don't want your poisons in our well. Hey, mister, you can go to hell. Guess I'm going back to school, study tourism management. And my man's planting a victory garden, washing the dishes and minding the kids. 'Cause it's born now, but payback later. We love this land and won't betray her. There's always something we can do. Hard work is gonna have to be what pulls us through. 'Cause you can't be rich on shattered land, or poor on land that's whole. Yeah, that's no choice they're offering. Hey, mister, can't put a bounty on our souls.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And today's program, if you're just tuning in, is America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew Bacevich, an international relations professor at Boston University, says now is the time to examine the Washington consensus on national security. He argues that national priorities must shift from fixing Afghanistan to fixing Detroit.
It is, it seems to me, starting to sink in that trillion-dollar deficits really are not sustainable. That having a national debt that is greater than the national GDP, and that day is not far off. If I'm not mistaken, the national debt has now exceeds $13 trillion. I think the total size of the economy is somewhere between $14 and $15 trillion. It's not going to take many more years of trillion-dollar deficits before we look like a North American version of Argentina in its worst days. Apologies to anybody here from Argentina. Permission granted to censor the tape so that we don't offend any Argentine supporters of the council. So what should replace the existing Washington rules? Well, it seems to me that we need a new credo and we need a new trinity. And what I would offer as a new credo is that we need to revive the conviction that America's primary purpose and obligation is to be America. What do I mean by that? That our purpose ought to be to fulfill the aspirations expressed in our founding documents, primarily the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. Not least among those aspirations is found in the concluding words of the preamble to the Constitution, which declares, I mean, these are words that we are so familiar with, but we sort of take it for granted that they actually, that the preamble is somehow simply a throat-clearing exercise before the framers of the Constitution got down to business. It's not. It is a succinct statement of what we think we are about in this union. And the concluding words state that the purpose of this union is, quote, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. What's the key word in that phrase? Key word is posterity. The question is not necessarily, do we live in freedom? We do. The question is whether or not we are conducting our affairs such that our children and our grandchildren will be able to live in freedom. I'm a historian. I'm not a prophet. But were I a prophet, I'd bet that a couple generations from now, people will curse us for having so mismanaged our affairs and will cause their opportunities to live in freedom to be severely circumscribed. There's a lot of talk, and there ought to be a lot of talk, especially in places like the Council, about moral obligation in public life, in international affairs. Without trying to be too sort of selfish about it, it seems to me that the primary moral obligation of the people that we elect and send to Washington, their primary obligation is to the American people. And again, notably, not simply to this generation, but to posterity. Now, if in the course of securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and of our posterity, the United States also serves as an exemplar to others. If we can, in keeping faith with the liberal values that we profess, that we can offer something that others can use, I'd say that's a good thing. But to say that's a good thing is not to say that we should confuse what really is an ancillary benefit for central purpose. Now, when it comes to thinking about and employing military power, I also think we need a new trinity. And I would propose that under the terms of this alternative trinity, A, that we define the primary duty station of the American soldier as America. Primary duty station of the American soldier as America. Not sole or exclusive. There certainly will be times in which we are called upon to employ our forces abroad, but we have to view that as a departure from the norm, rather than the norm. I mean, it ought to be, it's not astonishing because it's so widely accepted. It really ought to be astonishing that 60 plus years after the end of World War II, we still have U.S. forces in Germany and Japan. What exactly are the security threats that the Germans are worried about? And how is it that Germany, this robust democracy, can't handle them on their own? B, in my alternative trinity, we have to defend U.S. forces, we have to design U.S. forces to defend the United States of America and its most vital interests. And I understand that that phrase, vital interests, is a slippery one and invites debate over what qualifies and what doesn't qualify. And I would say, to some degree, the purpose of democratic politics ought to be to have a candid argument about the limits of our vital interests. I would welcome that debate. I'd simply insist that the notion that everything is a vital interest is absurd, and for all practical purposes, that's the circumstance in which we find ourselves today. It would not surprise me at all if next week we picked up the New York Times and find some member of the Obama administration insisting that Yemen is now becoming a vital interest of the United States of America, and therefore, actually, there's already a plan to provide a significantly expanded program of military assistance to the government of Yemen. And C, the third element of my alternative trinity, would be to argue that consistent with the just war tradition, you know what the just war tradition is? The just war tradition basically is this set of norms or guidelines devised to help us render judgments about prospective or ongoing conflicts to ascertain whether or not we should judge those conflicts as morally justifiable or not morally justifiable. Well, it seems to me that consistent with the just war tradition, we ought to employ force only as a last resort and only in self-defense. My point here is to argue that the just war tradition is not simply useful as a basis for moral thinking, It's also tremendously useful as a basis for prudential thinking about what makes sense. And even then, in employing force as a last resort and in self-defense, we should always be cognizant of the limited utility of violence as an instrument of statecraft. Its utility is not non-existent, but its utility is limited. We need to appreciate that. And further, we ought to also appreciate the fact that when we go to war, it's going to cost more than we possibly imagine, and it's going to give rise to a host of consequences that even the smartest people in the room are not going to be able to anticipate in advance. So you really are rolling the dice. There are times when you need to roll the dice, but boy, you are rolling the dice.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
They say the planet's warming, but I'm convinced it's not. Last Tuesday it was rather cool, today it's not so hot. And if it's getting hotter, I'm sure it's not by much. And probably due to sunspots, volcanoes or some such. Or maybe it's the Chinese, they make more smoke than us. I know there's many more of them, so let them catch the bus. One thing I am sure of, no need to make a fuss. Fire up those smoky chimneys and sing denial. I'm in denial. Don't talk to me of independent study or scientific trial. I'm in denial. Around me, I'll just hold my breath and say it isn't so. I call myself a skeptic, and I believe it's so. I'm skeptical of anything, I just don't want to know. Don't give me CSIRO or IPCC. I want some wacky Viscount with an architect's degree. He says it was much hotter X million years ago. I know that killed the dinosaurs, but they were rather slow. It's just a lot of scientists who think they're in the know. But I know better. Let's sing denial. Sing along. I'm in denial. When I see those eco-Nazis, I raise my arm and shout, sing hail. I'm in denial. Rise around me, I'll just hold my breath and say it isn't so. Those fires are not raging, no floods deluge the land. Those hurricanes and tornadoes are just flashes in the pan. The animals are doing fine, no species dying out. And half the bloody planet isn't choking in drought. The ice is not receding from either polar cap. I go with Tony Abbott, it's just a load of crap. This round-the-world disaster is an evil greeny trap. 'Cause everybody knows the world is flat. Denial. Sing! I'm in denial. Don't talk to me of independent study or scientific trial. I'm in denial. Deep in denial. And as the waters rise around me, I'll just hold my breath and say it isn't so. Oh no. As the waters rise around me, I'll just hold my breath and say it isn't so.
And now, back to Andrew Bacevich and America's Path to Permanent War.
Well, how likely is it that we will see any departure from the Washington rules? And I'm afraid to say you know the answer. And the answer is, it's not very likely. Why not? Well, two reasons. The first is that Washington itself, of course, is deeply invested into maintaining the status quo, is deeply invested in this credo, the existing credo, and the existing trinity, which does, in fact, benefit Washington, even if it does not work to the benefit of the American people. One of the other revelations, apparently, in the Woodward book that really is not a revelation, is that in that long interval during 2009, when President Obama was anguishing over what to do about Afghanistan, the Woodward book tells us what we already know, and that is that in a very fundamental and important way, the basic authority to decide was taken away from the president. The authority to decide was taken away from the president by the people who were framing the alternatives that were presented to the president. What should we do? And the alternatives that were presented to the president were three, basically, as far as we can tell. A surge with 20,000 additional troops, a surge with 30,000 additional troops, and a surge with 40,000 additional troops. Mr. President, we await your decision. And sort of, this is like Goldilocks and Three Bears, you know. One's too hot and one's too cold, so I'll pick 30,000. And I think in a very important way, that testifies to the way Washington works in the arena of national security and helps us understand the extent to which prying Washington loose from this consensus is going to be very, very difficult. But there is a second reason, and maybe a more troubling reason, why we're unlikely to see any departure from the Washington rules, and that's this. We, the people, have been too long conditioned to believe that any departure from this status quo, that abandoning the notion that we are called upon to save the world, closing down some portion of this global empire of bases, perhaps deciding not to spend as much on our military as the rest of the world spends on their militaries, that any backing away from that, we've been conditioned to believe that the results will be a retreat into isolationism and global chaos. In other words, having been conditioned along these lines, we no longer have the ability to ask basic, first-order, critical questions about national security policy. And I think this tendency to defer to Washington, to defer to people who ostensibly are a lot smarter than any of us, and who certainly have access to classified information which tells them things that we're not allowed to know, this tendency to defer to Washington may well pose the greatest of all obstacles to restoring good sense to U.S. policy. So with that, I'll stop, and thank you very much for your attention.
You spoke about our moral obligation to look at these issues, so I thank you for fulfilling yours, because it really was a wonderful talk. So with that being said, I'd like to open the floor to questions and give Bob James the first.
Okay. All right. So I support this organization, and so I get this. Thanks. Very good. Yeah. First, I wanted to say something about the book. This is a hell of a good book. You really ought to read it.
What'd you say, sir?
I said it's a very good book. A very good book. Not only that, it's easy to read. Considering it's a very, very serious book, it's easy to read. But I'm suggesting that you look at this book, get it, and work on it. Don't make it easy. Look at the footnotes. The footnotes will tell you things that you cannot believe. Alan Dulles said this. Maxwell Taylor said this. The two Kennedys said this. I cannot believe in view of what's happened, what they said. And you should look at that and see that. And you'll get a kick out of it. So, question. We've had a couple of presidents who have pointed out that there is evil in the world. Nobody likes the way they put it. What did Reagan say? Evil empire. And then Bush said axis of evil. I happen to believe that they are correct, that there is evil out there. But the United States, if you need military arms sometimes, only the United States can project power. If you don't believe that, you've got to believe that only the United States can sustain power out there. So what do you do? Somebody's got to, maybe from time to time, you have to take care of some of this. And that's my question.
Well, let me begin by concurring, not on the quality of the book, but on this issue of evil and its existence in the world, but not simply in the world beyond our borders. I didn't write about Reinhold Niebuhr in this book. I wrote to some degree about Reinhold Niebuhr in my previous book, and one of the things that I value from the writings of Reinhold Niebuhr, who said clearly, there is evil in the world and sometimes it must be addressed. But, he continued, never fall for the illusion that you yourself and your motives are pure, because that is a recipe for moral and strategic disaster. So the first point, I mean, is to concur, but also to say, yes, but that doesn't mean that we are necessarily in this different category. And I'm not trying to play a moral equivalence game here. I'm not trying to say that, oh, I guess since we overthrew the Mossadegh regime back in 1953, that somehow means we are akin to the great totalitarian dictatorships of the 20th century. Not at all. Not at all. But simply, let us be always aware of the fact that our motivations are not simply altruistic. Point number one. Point number two, I think, is, and this is where I think I would radically disagree with George W. Bush, who in the wake of 9/11 not only articulated his recognition of the existence of evil, but basically said, and we are going to go eliminate evil. And my point here is, it's not simply that evil exists, but evil is endemic. The existence of evil is a manifestation of the tragedy of history in which we find ourselves. Now, if you can't eliminate evil, what can you do with regard to evil? You can ignore it. That's not a wise course. You can do your best to find ways to cope with it, to minimize its effect, to minimize the danger that it poses. And it seems to me, in trying to figure out what do we do about evil, rather than sort of beginning with the notion, well, I guess we better go excise it, you know, get me a carrier battle group, we ought to step back, try to evaluate where it fits in the pecking order of evil, you know, where Hitler and Stalin are up there at number 10, judge the extent to which it demands a response, and then to try to be cool-headed in thinking about the range of alternatives which are available. The first response ought not to be a military response. And I say that absolutely conceding that there are times, there have been times, and there will be times when you need to opt for war. My own sense is that as this national security consensus that I have described has embedded itself in the way Washington thinks, and especially since the end of the Cold War, when the notion that we were the almighty superpower took hold, that we've been too quick to reach for the gun and pull the trigger, and we ought not to do that.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. It is I, George W. Bush. I'm the president. And I'm here tonight with a detailed report on the economy. Now, many people do not realize that since I have been in office, there has been tremendous growth in one major part of the economy. I'm talking, of course, about the national debt. It has grown tremendously since I've been in office. Now, people don't realize that this is actually a money-saving tactic on my part. See, the way I figure, if we no longer have any money, if we no longer have any wealth as a nation, we can see nothing but tremendous savings. We would no longer need a Department of the Treasury. You're not buying it, are you? Who am I kidding? I gotta figure out what I'm gonna do. Ain't no surplus, now it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Oh, the balance on our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell your kids they're gonna have to pay. I wonder what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. I have got to pay these bills. I could sell Dick Cheney's pills or put Congress on eBay. We owe, we owe, we owe. We owe, I know. I couldn't leave the tax code alone. Ain't no surplus, now it's gone. Here is my brand new budget pitch. I'm gonna tell each American. Everybody will be rich if each person will just switch to Geico's insurance plan.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.